编辑处。
Hello, welcome to Aughty Talk. I can't believe it, but it's the final episode of Series 1. I'm Louise Crooms, your host. I'm autistic and I have an autistic family. And I really wanted to get the information out there about autism. And that's what Series 1 is about. It's about finding information about different aspects of it, what people think about it, what it's like to get diagnosed, how young people feel about it, how it affects the genders. And today we are going to talk about gender, the differences between men and women when it comes to autism and the diagnosis. We will find out today from Andy, who has been right across the podcast, but you might remember particularly from episode 1, where he shared his journey to get a diagnosis. And today we find out the results on this podcast. I will be talking to Jo, who you might remember from the very first podcast when she talked about her sensory difficulties around buses. Well, today is her full interview, and she's a very strong and independent lady, and she has a lot to say about raising children, about being autistic, and what it's like to be on the spectrum. She will be sharing with us some amazing things, including how to deal with Christmas, what to do with teenagers, and what general household activity she likes doing that she finds most relaxing. I will also speak to Jed, who's been joining us across the podcast, to talk about his experiences as an autism specialist nurse. And he'll be talking about gender and the issues around it. And I will have a rant about something that annoys me and something that's getting worse with all the packages that we keep getting delivered, particularly my husband, who's always, always ordering things online. This is episode 6. It's called Gender. Let's start by meeting Jo. Jo is a mum of two in her 40s, and she found out that she was autistic 4 years ago. I asked her what life was like before she realised she was autistic.
My life before diagnosis was very, very confusing. They told me I had postnatal depression after having my kids, but I knew it wasn't depression, so I basically struggled every day of my life with why was I so different to everybody else on the planet.
How did you know you were different?
I've always known I was different from being a kid. One of my favourite games when I was a kid was standing outside the front door, because I lived on Mellor Road in Ashton, and I used to take car reg plates of cars driving up the street and the colours, and I would be able to tell you if that car had been up the street before. That was one of my favourite games. So yeah, I've always known I was weird and different and argumentative and just didn't fit in with anybody around me.
And how did you feel with your family? What were your family like? What was your family background?
I felt as though I was an alien and just plonked into the family, because I have nothing in common with any of my family. They all drink, I don't drink. My mum and my dad used to smoke, and I don't smoke. And I've got two brothers, and I just always felt as I was a stranger in my own family. Still do, but not as bad as when I was growing up.
How big is your family? Who have you got in there?
There was me, my mum, my dad, and two brothers, and we had two dogs. But then after that, there was like my grandparents, my grandma, granddad, and I had an auntie that died when I was about 8. So that left two uncles on my mum's side. And then on my dad's side, we never really saw anybody from my dad's family. There was my gran. And then my dad had a half brother and sister. So that in itself was big issues, because there was half brothers and sisters. So my dad didn't see them as family. But looking back now, I can actually see these autistic traits on both of my on my mum and my dad, really. But yeah, we didn't really have a big extended family neither. So it was like the small family unit.
Tell me about Christmas or a time where you were together. What was it like in your household?
Oh, Lord. I didn't like socialising even with my family. So Christmas and everything was really hard. I suppose the ones I can really remember is when I was a teenager, and it was like, because I was driving, we'd sort of, my grandparents had come to my mum and dad's, And then my mum and my nan used to cook all the Christmas dinner while my dad and the men all went to the pub. And then I had to go and pick them up and take them to the pub and bring them back because I didn't drink, and I drove. So I was constantly being used for that. But I hated Christmas because it was the forced formalities, I guess, of what you have to do, when all I wanted to do was just go and sit in my bedroom and be on my own.
What do you think is the worst thing about it?
About Christmas?
Yeah.
The having to be around people, or supposedly that's what you're supposed to do. However, now I've got my diagnosis and I've got my own family, it's great because it is literally just me, Andy, and my boys at Christmas. And I love it. And people try and say, oh, you'll have to come to us. No, sorry, not going to happen on this planet. I just don't do it.
So what are your Christmases like now?
Quiet.
Orty talk.
When you look back at school, what was school like for you?
Horrendous. Growing up at school, because obviously I went to a mainstream school, and I didn't really have friends. You had people you associated with in school, but you didn't mix with them out of school, so they weren't true friends, but people would see them as your friends, but they weren't. And then all the expectations of this fashion rubbish. Whoa, God, no, didn't follow fashion. You know, it's like, and then all the girls were into lads, and you just sit there and think, oh, God, I'm not into this. And it's just what they expect you to be into. I actually sat with all the lads at school, you know. It's like the lads and me got on, put me with girls. It was just like alien. I couldn't do it. And I just think girls are so bitchy at school to begin with. I mean, God knows how they go on nowadays. But no, me in school, no. And I remember in English, because obviously being autistic and you're very literal, and if I understand things, it goes in and it stays in. So if I have a conversation with somebody, that's it, I remember. But give me a book to read, it's like, nah, forget that. I'm not reading that. Just tell me what it's about. And in English, we'd sit there, and at the end of the day, everybody was dying to get out of class. But no, up went Joanne's hand, asking questions to the English teacher, like, sir, but what about, what this? And everyone would be groaning at me, going, can you just not shut up? We want to leave the classroom. I'm like, yeah, but I need to understand. So, yeah, school was very hard.
Did you have a favourite subject?
At school, I loved sociology.
Wow, why is that?
I suppose because you can question and have the conversations that I love to have, where you get to the nitty-gritty of things. I hated maths, hated English, and all the mainstream subjects. Hated geography because I get lost on a straight road, for crying out loud. You know, I need a sat nav on a straight road. So, no, didn't do geography and history. At school, hated history with a passion because you're force-fed all these numbers and dates and you have to remember. And it's like, God, no, can't do that. You know, there's too much in my head to begin with. But now I love history.
You found that different as you get older?
Yeah, because it's about what you want to look into and what you want to choose to digest, I suppose. But my son says that now to me. He's at uni. And he hates syllabuses. He loves art, don't get me wrong. But the fact that he's got to write his feelings and his thoughts on art, it drives him mental.
That's a difficult part for him on that,
yeah,
that area.
Yeah.
And in terms of being at school, I mean, I remember being at school and there was a thing where I used to have my hair in quite a low ponytail, which for some reason people took great offence to, because at the time the fashion was permed, dead tight ponytail at the back, so they were like an actual pony. And it was... I also got the sense everyone seemed to get a bra and be showing it everybody for some reason.
Yeah, and we're just like, nah, what do you want to show that?
Did people say anything about your appearance?
Yeah, so they just find something, don't they? And if you don't fit in, that's it. But I had quite short hair because my mum was, she was awful when I was growing up. Because she used to have to brush my hair for me because it was dead knotting, I'm head sore. And I'd get a brush wrapped around my head, you know. And the threat of, if you don't stand still, I'm going to have all your hair cut off. And she did. Yeah, pretty grim growing up, I'll tell you.
Orty talk.
Jo will be back in a couple of minutes to tell you exactly what ordinary, mundane household things she likes doing that gives her unbelievable amounts of joy. See if you can guess what it is. After we hear more from Jo, we'll finally get an update on Andy. Has he been diagnosed with autism or not? He's been waiting quite a long time to find out. He's a man in his 60s and he's desperate to know. Before that, one thing that completely annoys me is what happens when I'm in my house. It's time for...
It's Auty Rant.
I'm completely on my own in the house and I'm just about to have a bath. When you get a chance in life to have a bath, never. So I take my clothes off and I'm about to get in the bath when suddenly... the doorbell rings. Oh, no! Why do they always ring at this time? Exactly when I'm going to the toilet or exactly when I'm getting into the bath. What am I going to do? Because the thing is, by the time I get there, people have no patience anymore. They'll be gone and I'll just be there. The only reason I've got a door is because I need to get out of my house. But the door isn't for you. It isn't for you to be knocking on. I shouldn't have installed that doorbell. I guess I thought I had to. But I put a sign. It said no cold calling. No hawkers. Don't come round. Don't bother me. I wish I had a sign that could say, get lost. Don't knock on my door. The thing is, people very rarely ever knock on your door because they always text you first or ring you first. Or not even so much ring now because people don't really talk. They just text you. So you go and you expect someone. Although the problem is they're always late and you have to sit there waiting for them. It's so annoying. But even worse is someone who hasn't even told you they're coming. So it means you don't know them and they're knocking on the door. What do they want? They probably want something for you, to sell you a dishcloth or to ask you to vote Conservative or to do something or other. You're not interested. You don't care. You're not interested in opening the door, but you feel that you have to. I ignore it. I feel like I'm hiding in my own house, like I'm burgling it myself, and I wait completely naked until the person's gone. Oh no, what if it's something important? It won't be, it won't be. The next day, I'm walking round in my nightdress, just walking past the door, and I hear a knock. Oh no, someone's at the door again, and I'm in my nightie. How can I answer the door in my nightie? That's ridiculous. And then I'm stood by the coat rack, so I put a big, thick winter coat on, right in the middle of summer, and I answer the door. The guy looks at me. He must be thinking, what on earth is she wearing? It's absolutely boiling outside, 30 degrees, and she's in that big coat. But I've got my nightie on underneath, but I don't want to tell him. It's really weird. So he says, all right, love, I've got a parcel. Ah, parcels. Oh, no. I remembered, ordering online is brilliant, but you've got to answer the door to them. Before now, I've had an argument with my husband, pushing him, you answer, you answer, you answer, like we're 5 years old. Except the problem is, five-year-olds normally want to answer the door. In our case, we don't. Thankfully, I had opened the door. Sign for this, love, would you? And then he goes, hang on, it's for next door. What? For next door? Yeah, you don't mind taking it in, do you? I wish I'd never opened the door. I'm not that miserable, honestly, when I answer the door. Sometimes my house is like a sorting office. This is Auty Talk. Let's get back to the interview with Jo. And she gets very excited about a very ordinary household chore, but she thinks it's quite magical.
When I got to college, it was quite bizarre because my pastime was doing ironing because I used to have to do all the family's ironing from age 11, believe it or not. So I actually took that one step forward to actually earn some money. I used to do the next door neighbour's ironing and friends of the family's ironing because it doesn't bother me. Now, what teenager loves to stand and iron? This one does. And then at college, I'd done 2 years at college, and obviously the lecturers heard this, you know, because I did hotel catering and management at college. And then I went back to college afterwards and I saw one of the lecturers and the first thing he remembered was I used to do ironing, and I thought that was really bizarre.
I love the ironing. Describe to me what it was like when you ironed.
Even now ironing is great because that's the first thing my dad's mum taught me at 11 because she used to be a seamstress in one of the palaces at Hyde Park when she was growing up. So I was taught to iron the professional way. So I learnt to do shirts, believe it or not, first. After socks, obviously.
What's the secret to a good shirt ironing?
Oh,
I need to know this.
I do the collar first and then do the piece across the back and then do the sides and the back and then the arms.
The arms, I can't get them to not be all crunched up because I do one side and they iron in. Creases on
yeah,
the other.
How do you avoid that? I think just because I've been doing it since I was 11, you know, and I'm like in my 40s now, it's a lot of practice.
You'd think that you'd then go on to do that sort
of
career.
Not a chance.
What did you do when you left school?
I left school, went to college, did the hotel catering. So from there, I went to the Avant Hotel in Oldham and was a receptionist. And that caused a lot of problems in itself as well. Looking back, you can see the patterns throughout life. And at the hotel, we used to have to take ownership of... we used to do lates and earlies. So if you booked a customer in, you check them out the next day, obviously. So because it was a hotel in Oldham, we used to have a lot of businessmen that used to come Monday to Friday. So because I'm chatty catty and I used to just take an interest in people, they'd all want me to call them by the first names. Well, that's a no-no. You're not allowed to call them by the first names. It's like, well, hold on a minute. These guests are asking me to do this. Yes, but you don't do it. Yes, but these customers are asking me to do that. Yep, you don't do it. So it's like, oh, whatever. And then because I didn't drive back then, because I was only just turned 18, I used to have to stay over in the hotel. So we had to go via the bar to clock out in the kitchen. So obviously all the guests would see you walking through and they'd be like, oh, Joanne, you all right? Yeah. Come and have a drink. No, I'm not allowed. Because you're very literal, you're not allowed to do these things. So it's like, nope, can't do it. And because, like, when you're talking to the receptionist and all the rest of it, making the bookings, I used to get really friendly with the receptionist. And I used to have all my own personal phone numbers to everybody and his dog. And this one particular day, one of the big wigs had gone and his brother was still in the room. And it's normally the big brother that pays. And I hadn't dealt with this booking, like, you know, this fairness of, you know, you check them in, you check them out. Anyway, it got all left to me to deal with. And it's like, well, hold on a minute, I didn't check them in. Yeah, but you're dealing with it. And it's like, whoa, hold on a minute. The unfairness of things in life caused so many problems, even to this day. Because if there's an unfairness, I will fight cat and dog and, you know, it all out there. So anyway, I dealt with this problem and I rang the receptionist, not a problem, and they made the payment over the phone. Anyway, this went on and on and on, and it's just the more you sort of stand up for yourself, the more you stand out and the more you're a problem. So obviously it came time for people to be made redundant, so I was kicked out the door and I actually ripped up all my own personal info for all the receptionists and everything. I thought, you're not having all that. And I just left and it was great. But that's followed me all through my life. I get on with people. People can talk to me. They find me easy to talk to and people get jealous.
Orty talk.
Thank you to Jo. We'll be back to her very soon. But first, it's time to find out what on earth is going on with Andy. We met him in the very first podcast while he was going through the diagnostic process. Andy's here to explain the results. Now, you have an update for us, don't you?
Yes, I do, yeah. I've had the concluding report from my ADOS assessment, which shows I am indeed autistic.
So you might remember Andy from the very first podcast, or indeed for any of our podcasts, because you've been with us for a few weeks now. But the very first one, we were talking about diagnosis and you getting diagnosed, and you can now confirm that you are, in fact, autistic.
Yeah, that's right.
That's it. How did it feel to find out?
I was relieved, because as it got nearer the time, I think I was beginning to think, oh, but if I'm not, does that make sense?
I absolutely have felt that with me.
Did you feel that?
And my kids. Oh, definitely, right at the very last minute.
And
you feel that way, you feel like, have I just made this up?
Yeah, one of your listeners or a person who you were talking to a while ago on Auti Talk said something like, I'm 60 years old now, or whatever age it was a similar age to myself. And if I find out that I am autistic, it'll just put into context everything that's gone before.
Yeah, absolutely. That was on the podcast. Yeah,
was that the podcast?
Was Steve. Yeah. Mm.
And I think that's absolutely spot on, that.
Because I like to challenge people slightly and say, you know, what would be the benefit of being diagnosed? Because that is a question that people ask.
Yeah.
Why do it when you get to a certain age?
Yeah.
And I think the overwhelming feeling for most people that I've certainly spoken to anyway has been because I want to know.
Yeah, why not? Just throw the question back, can't you, really? Well, why not?
You had not an unusual way of being assessed, but certainly one that I've not heard of in this area for a while. You had the ADOS, but the adult version.
Yeah.
How was that for you?
I didn't know what to expect, obviously, a certain amount of trepidation. The first meeting is, actually, it wasn't necessarily intended for myself. They wanted to speak to a person who has known me for a long time. Now, in an adult, it's obviously, the ideal person would be a parent. I'm 61, so that wasn't really suitable. Both my parents are sadly deceased now, and we decided the next or most likely person to choose would be my eldest daughter. She's 28, and she came in with me, or I went in with her, because they wanted some information about my early years. So obviously I could provide that.
What was it like sitting there with your daughter as she was answering questions about you?
It didn't feel odd, really. I suppose a tiny bit odd. But when she was speaking, I thought, wow, I didn't realise that. I've always known my dad as my dad, and the way he is, and he's always quiet and doesn't like parties and doesn't like the social rituals that tend to go on. It's something that was obvious to her when she started going to other people's houses. She'd say, my dad's obviously just a quiet person.
So when you'd done the interview, what was the next stage that you had to do?
They wanted me to do the ADOS, then actually call in to do the ADOS. I took about an hour. It involved me going into the room with a speech therapist and another professional who was like a note taker, observer. And it just involves a lot of chatting. And there's a book, and there's this big oversized spoon that I saw, and I was drawn to it right away because I couldn't get around the reflection, and the refraction was all wrong. The light refracting from it and the way it was drawn was totally wrong. You wouldn't see that in the world. It's like one of those impossible puzzles that you see.
So what did she say to you when you said, this isn't right, this spoon?
She said, what do you mean? I said, well, it should be like this. And I drew the actual, where the light should reflect off a true image if it was drawn properly.
You just had a thing with, because you like photography, don't you?
Yeah.
You knew it was wrong.
Yeah, definitely. If the perspective's not right, it's not right.
It does your head in.
Yeah.
This reminds me of my son, who from his from his diagnosis test that he had done, in the test, they said to him, right, pick up the boat. And my son was going, it isn't a boat. And they're going, oh, right, what is it then? It's a cruise ship.
Yeah.
And they were
like,
so they spent about 15 minutes discussing what this boat was. And I think it had nothing to do with the test whatsoever. It was just he had to get it right.
I kept on looking back on this page. She said, well, never mind then. Try and forget about the spoon.
Autotalk.
A few weeks after that, I got a report back with the definitive results in it. The ADOS is only a guide, apparently. They look at that in total with all the other information that they've been given.
That's good to know that, actually, because your story in particular with Meg, your daughter, who's featured on the podcast, with how long you had to wait with Meg and that you had to do several ADOSs over numerous years.
Yeah.
I just thought this was going to be my daughter totally, because my son went for his diagnosis and there was no problem whatsoever, was given a diagnosis. And I just knew the way that my daughter was, and this thing with girls presenting slightly differently and being quite creative and quite imaginative, often quite social, it's really difficult whether they're going to see it. And for you, it wasn't right away, was it, for Meg?
Such a lot of, I use the word fight in a deliberate sense. We had to literally fight with certain people to get any kind of recognition that Meg could be on the spectrum.
Recently, we've celebrated that my daughter has officially got her diagnosis, but with Meg, what happened to her, I was scared that we wouldn't find out about my daughter until she was about 14.
Yeah, I remember
you
saying
that. So I was really worried about this, and eventually she did the ADOS, and it didn't show it in the ADOS. When they eventually said, listen, she didn't meet the criteria for the ADOS, but we've got more than enough information from observations elsewhere and people's professional opinion that we're happy to give the diagnosis. And I was ready to fight so hard. And then suddenly which was great. They said, yeah, we agree with you. We see it. It did take a few years, but I thought it could be another 10 years and I was ready to fight. So yeah. To have that thing where they just say to you, yeah, she's got it, that's it. And I didn't know what to do with the fight. A, it shows how far we've come, that people are now seeing it better. And B, it made me think, what am I going to do with this fight? I can't run through the centre of Manchester screaming, I was right all along.
But isn't it a relief?
Such a relief.
The relief is that it's your daughter will now get help that she needs.
Have you told people? Do you ring people up and go, hello, I'm Andy. I've got something to tell you.
I've only told my close family, they know, but that I've not sort of gone through my phone book and said it.
Artie talk.
I'm sure me and Andy can agree on this. We've gone through our whole lives trying to do stuff that it's blatantly obvious we cannot do. So when you get that diagnosis, you just go, right, then I'll stop I'll stop beating myself up about that now.
And the thing is, it's like a freedom. It's like a freedom moment.
There's a certain amount of acceptance where you just go, yeah, it's what it is.
Yeah.
This is what it is. Because in previous years, and I know this does affect a lot of people, you find yourself getting very depressed, berating yourself.
Oh, definitely.
I want to do better. I should know how to do that. Why am I not remembering that? Why is it always me that has this problem? Why have I spoken like that? Why don't people understand me? Yeah. Why don't I understand them? And suddenly you just go, oh, yeah, right. I mean, it doesn't make it any easier, but certainly it makes you go, okay, now I have all the information I need to not beat myself up about this any further. Thank you so much, Andy.
That's okay.
You're amazing.
It's been really nice to chat again.
Amazing.
And I do hope that some of this has helped someone.
That's what we want to do.
Yeah.
We want to enter into our own minds and put them out for the world to hear and say, this is our mind. Do you like it? And thank you very much for everyone who's got in contact with the podcast as well. They've been very complimentary about you, Andy, and about you, about how you're talking about yourself and your mind and how I'm talking about myself and my mind. And that's helpful to people, and I'm glad it is. And thank you for your responses.
Artie talk.
I'm so pleased for Andy. He's absolutely delighted. Coming up, I've still got to talk to Jed about gender issues. He's an autism specialist nurse, and Joe will be here for Mum's Club. Now it's time for the final part of Joe's interview. I asked her what her relationships were like when she was younger.
Relationships growing up were very much... I suppose I used to get into relationships with the preconceived society idea of relationships, what you should and you shouldn't do. And quite frankly, I suppose I slept with quite a few people I shouldn't have slept with because I thought that's what they expected. And now looking back, I know it was wrong, but it's because that's what was expected. So it wasn't necessarily what you wanted to do. It's just something you did. And then I've had a few long-term relationships that have sort of gone west because I don't understand relationships too well. Then I've been married and had my children. Obviously, I've divorced him. And I'm on my second marriage. And now this is amazing because he gets me. He understands the autism. And it's working now. And then I was actually nearly 25, just turned 25 when I had Josh in the end. And I've never held a baby at this point because me and babies just don't mix. They cry, I give them back. So I'd never held a baby. And then I'd had my son. And the midwife plonks him on me after I'd given birth on the ward. And I remember thinking, what the hell am I supposed to do with this now? And that was it. That was, you know, forever. And I remember thinking that, you know, this is forever. Wow. My autism really went off the scale where I couldn't cope because when you have children, there is no routine. There's no set structure. And that's what has done me in ever since. I can't cope because there's no structure to my life anymore where, you know, something goes wrong with your kid at school and you're getting a text going, oh, you've got to come and pick them up. It's like a panic. This is what people don't see. Because I'm a parent, it's all trebled. But when the kids were growing up, So Josh, I was four. He was 4 months old, and I had to go and have my appendix out. And that's where this so-called depression hit, because I had to stay in. I think it was a 4 or 5 day stay, but they had to let me out on day 3 because my anxieties were so bad. They was elevating my blood pressure all the time and my temperature, because I kept saying, no, I can't be in here. I've got a 4-month-old baby at home. I need to be at home. So that's where I felt this wave come over of me, and that's where it sort of came from.
And when you were sort of dealing with stress and difficulty, what sort of, how does that show itself in you?
It's a lot different now to what it was when my kids were little. When my kids were little, I never used to leave the house. I didn't until my diagnosis, to be fair. I just used to, before I met Andy as well, I used to drive the car all the time. The car was mine. So literally, the kids were in the car. I'd go to my mum and my dad's, or I'd go wherever and then go home, and then I was safe in my house. Shut the door, that's it. I'm all nice and safe. So I never used to mix. I didn't go to the parent and toddler groups, because being around people, I'd rather stick pins in my eyes. And shopping was a nightmare as well in itself. You know, you have to take the kids. Sometimes I would actually ask my mum if she'd have the kids so I could go and do shopping on my own, because the thought, and it's like I never used to go to Ashton with the boys, because as kids and parents will probably know, you take two kids to like Ashton, one goes one way and one goes the other way, and you're like, holy crap, which one do I go for first? So I never used to do that. All my life, I've struggled. I've known all my own issues. And then I had my children. So as you go through the school system and you see your kids struggling with different issues at school, and you have all the arguments in the schools of my child needs help, but yeah, you can't get the help because they're not in the bottom 5% of the class and all the rest of it. And your heart tugs. Well, mine got to, oh, Josh starting college. So when they go for the 2 days to see if they like the college, he came back and I said to him, have you made some new friends? Because all Josh's friends up to this point had all gone through primary with him and everything, and they weren't very good friends. They'd let him down. So here's me thinking, oh, we'll get to college, you'll make some new good friends here. Great. He come home and he went, no. Oh, what do you mean, no? I've got them all pegged, Mum. What do you mean you've got them all pegged? How can I tell him to make friends and accept people when I would be exactly the same as him? Because me and my eldest are like two peas in a pod. I actually know what he's thinking and going to do before he even does it. So I'm sat watching him and I'm thinking, oops, I do that. And it doesn't look right when you're seeing it from your eyes looking out. So then that's when I started looking into what maybe he had. So I went online and I was looking at ADHD and all the other stuff, the ADD, and I came across autism and I'm like, nah. So I thought, right, go on, let's have a look. And then I saw a list of the traits and I'm like, uh-oh, I do that and I do that and I do that and that and that and that. And the list was just getting bigger. So I went to my husband and my close friend and I said, do you two think I've got autism? And they both went, nah, don't be stupid. All right, do me a favour, look at these lists. And they both looked at them and they both looked at me and went, oh, you do this and you do this and you also do this. And my friend would be like, and you do this. And she gave me examples that I didn't even realise. And they were both like, maybe you have. And then it was like, oh, okay. So then I went to the GP, which maybe wasn't brilliant because it was a brand new GP for me. And I'd never seen this GP. And I went in and, you know, after looking at all these videos on YouTube and all the rest of it, and I'm in tears thinking, wow, this is my story. I could be saying this. And the GP said, I'll refer you for some counselling. But luckily the counsellor I got was a counsellor I'd seen before who'd seen my name and contacted me, and I told him, and he's like, at first it was like, what makes you think it's this? And so after I told him, he actually said to me, he believed me. So for the next 9 weeks of counselling with him, it was all about the autism. And he actually came out with a nice comment. It was meant in a nice way, and some people took it negatively. And he actually says to me, "You're okay until you open your mouth to start talking."
Autism talk.
And did you ever think at any point, "Oh, I don't want this, it sounds awful. Nope. I don't want to be autistic"?
Never, never in a million years. I wanted to know who I was, why I was different. And after my diagnosis, it was amazing. It was like I've been reborn. And I am so proud that I'm autistic, because if I wasn't autistic, I wouldn't be who I am.
Why would you want one as an adult? Once you've gone through the school system, and in your case, you're in your 40s, why would you want to get diagnosed?
Why would I not want to know who I am? Why would I not want to be able to say to people, this is why I'm different? Yeah, we're not supposed to have these labels in life. However, without having a label, there's no doors opened. It's who I am. It's how I think. It's how I behave. It's how I see life. It's how I've parented my kids, because I've parented my kids autistically, obviously without knowing. And I'm now meeting more autistic adults from my diagnosis who are actually saying to me, because I've actually sat and thought many times, I'm a bad parent because I don't do what normal parents do. I don't go to the park. I don't go to the cinema with them and noisy, busy places. I allow my kids to have their own time, their own space in the bedroom, and just be who they are. And I've got adults now saying to me they wish their parents was like that when they were growing up. So I can see now what I've done parenting my children is for the best of them. Autism is something you're born with. It's not something you can get rid of. It's not something that can just happen. So why are people not actually listening more?
It's autism talk.
There's got to be more autism awareness, and I definitely feel the fact that I'm autistic, both of my kids are autistic, and we live an autistic life. More people need to know and understand that it's okay to be different, but we need the acceptance for it to be okay to be different.
What don't people get, do you think?
They don't get the whole... Well, at first, they don't understand how different our brains are wired. Because like in the school system, obviously, because Harry was 17, my youngest, so that's recent. He's only been diagnosed this April. So even the schools that are supposed to understand about autism were telling me he's not autistic. I'm like, yes, he is. We're not seeing the signs. I'm like, yes, you are, but you're not putting them all together in the big jigsaw. You're taking one example and reasoning it away, because all kids do that. But my son was actually saying to the teachers, word for word, "I don't understand why my friends say what they say to me." That in itself is a big autistic thing, and yet they were still reasoning it away. So there needs to be more understanding on how high-functioning autistics struggle, because we actually struggle in the social situations and things like pull your socks up. You know, kids might literally pull the socks up. Then they're being facetious. No, they're doing what you've asked them to do, because we are very literal. And this is what people don't understand.
Autism talk.
Why is it not really seen in women?
Probably because it was a bloke that came up with the autism label, maybe. But women mask and we hide very, very well. So we're taught from very young that we have to keep house, we have to cook, we have to clean, we have to look smart, we have to, you know, everything, the makeup and all the rest of it. So as a girl, you sort of have an awareness of what's expected of us. So therefore, we just pretend and we go down that route. So that's why it's harder. But then also, you get labelled with your hormonal. It's PMT. How many women have, you know, a bad day and the bloke will go, "Oh, you're due on? Oh, wow, that really winds me up." So, yeah, it's hormones. It's anything but autism traits.
It's autism talk.
We don't like to highlight what we struggle with, and the meltdowns and the shutdowns and the tears and the temper tantrums. We only show those that we love, that we live with, that nasty side to us, because we are taught that it's nasty and it's not right. So we do hide it. And I think since diagnosis, I must admit, I don't hide that as much as I used to anymore. And if people don't accept it, it's tough. So I'm all about awareness and acceptance.
Thanks very much, the amazing Jo, for her honesty, teaching us about autism and how it affects women, mothers and people getting diagnosed later in life. It is now time for Mum's Club, and it's not the last we've heard from Jo.
Mum's Club.
Jo has stayed on to join me for Mum's Club, which is the woohoo Mum's Club, which is the part of the podcast where we talk about mum issues. If you are a mum with a child on the autistic spectrum, life can be very difficult. Do you agree, Jo?
Oh, yes.
It may be made even more difficult if you are also on the spectrum, which me and Jo both are. So that could be even more difficult. We're going to talk a little bit about your children because they're older. So what are they doing education-wise?
Right, I've got my eldest has done college. He did very well doing A-levels. He did three arts and he passed them with A's and B's and a C. And then he went and did a year apprenticeship in game art, and then he's now just finished his first year on a 3D visual effects degree at Futureworks in Manchester University. And my youngest has just finished his first year at Ashton Sixth Form doing music production. And he does all this sort of stuff with editing music and stuff.
You've got a lot of challenges because it's not specifically out for your autism.
Yes.
You might not be in a school that's specific for autism. What sort of problems were you seeing around sort of high school?
Where they don't understand social peer groups, so they were ostracised quite a lot and they'd have temper tantrums and crying fits because they didn't fit in, they couldn't make the friends, they couldn't keep the friends. The school were just sort of saying, oh, this is normal teenage behaviour. No, it's not. My kids were saying they don't understand the peers. And the school, I suppose, as a parent, you need to make friends quickly with your senko of the school and also of the peer mentors for your year groups, because they are the ones that are going to help you as a parent get through the school. Because at the end of the day, they're going to be the ones you need to be speaking to get them to help little Johnny or Sally or whatever you've got in school get through their days. Because I did find out that in a school situation, the people that understand about your children are just the people that deal with your children, which to me seems really bizarre, because if they're struggling, I think all the teachers need to understand about your child, not just the day-to-day teachers that are teaching them. So make friends with your senko and the peer mentors, not the peer mentor, the teachers, like the year group, head of year or whatever. Make friends with them and keep in contact with them.
I've got much younger children and I'm really scared for their teenage years. I see this thing coming towards me. I'm scared of what's going to happen. I don't know what I'm going to tell them. I'm sat there, I'm thinking, the conversations you've got to have, and then your children might be more vulnerable, more naive.
Yes, very much so.
And that hurts me. Tell me it's going to be okay, Jo.
As an autistic, in an autistic house, it's quite interesting because you tend to find that when your child goes into an autistic meltdown, it sets me off instantly. So it's like, and then it's worse when they're both on meltdowns, you know, because like at college and uni where they're both coming to the deadlines at the end of the year, you'll find it more when they come into SATs and exams or coursework, because they tend to leave it till the last minute as well. And that's not because they're being horrible brats leaving it all to the last minute. It's because we have time management issues and how to manage our time wisely. So they struggle a lot coming to do coursework and things. And then there's like huge meltdowns in the whole house. So I'm very sorry. No.
It's going not bad. Great. How do you cope? Give us some tips.
Andy! That's how I cope.
Get the old husband in.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's like the chilled out one. Because like when all three of us are on meltdowns at the same time, I really feel sorry for him, because he doesn't know which one of us to calm down first, because we all have different coping strategies as well. Yeah.
It's tough. Know yourself, know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I think as a parent, you can feel that you have to be the mature one. And if you've gone into a situation where you're not coping well, sometimes time out is the best thing to go for.
Yeah.
I found myself trying to cope.
Yeah.
When I couldn't.
I think as the kids have got older as well, because obviously before my diagnosis, I didn't understand myself really, even though I did, but I didn't know what it was. I'd be snapping at the kids for no reason because I was on a meltdown. I mean, I always apologised to my kids afterwards and explained why I'd done what I'd done and shouted, but it still made you feel really bad. But now the autism's in the house and we understand what it is. It's great because we now all give each other the space we need.
Auntie Talk.
Thanks so much, Jo, for staying on for Mum's Club and being a brilliant guest on the podcast. It's just time to talk to Jed now. Jed is an autism specialist nurse who's kindly talked to me over the past 6 episodes. If you've missed any of the previous ones, have a listen back. He generally features at the end. Last but no means least,
it's Jed.
Is there a difference in gender? I mean, is there a gender imbalance? I mean, I think I might know the answer to this question, but is there, in your experience, and why do you think that is?
I haven't, for a long time, looked at our referrals and looked for a gender, you know, what the percentage is. I would guess, off the top of my head, there isn't much more than a 10% difference in terms of people coming to us for an adult diagnosis. I think, historically, there was a massive gender imbalance in terms of people that got a diagnosis. So far more men got a diagnosis because historically it was seen as, autism was, for some offensive reason, seen as by some people extreme maleness almost. So the things that autistic people can find a little bit challenging or more difficult are the kind of things that blokes aren't stereotypically very good at. Therefore, that was sort of a commonly held view in the 80s. Therefore, more men got a diagnosis. So it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. So people look at the statistics and think, more men are autistic, so therefore, if a woman goes to the doctors, the GP might think, well, oh no, you're a woman, so this is more a male thing. That woman doesn't get a diagnosis. It just feeds into itself. So of all the stats that I don't trust, stats on gender is probably the biggest one. It could be that slightly more men are autistic than women or not, I don't know. But I certainly don't think it's, you know, in the past it used to be something like 1 in 10 autistic people were female, and that's clearly can't be right, I don't think.
And they were often presenting with more behaviours. They had, it was, you know, more obvious quite often in a lot of the women that were diagnosed. Do you think there's any specific issues for women that have been reported amongst the people that you've been working with?
In terms of getting the diagnosis or?
Either getting the diagnosis or that seems to stick out more with a woman rather than with autistic people in general.
Yeah. I suppose talking in really broad stereotypes, maybe autistic women have felt more pressured to sort of fit in with society than autistic men have felt. Maybe it's a little bit more acceptable for a man to be seen as slightly eccentric, for want of a better word, or to be seen as a little bit of a computer geek. Again, I'm not trying to offend anybody. Whereas it's seen as a bit more, women have just got to fit in with society. And I know lots of men that would say, well, actually, I felt like that as well, and I did lots of masking. But I think, on the whole, maybe women have done a bit more masking in terms of, I've got to fit in, so I've got to go out. So you look at the history of the socialising, and they were doing loads of socialising in their teenage years, but actually they would find that really, really draining and really, really challenging. And they were doing it because that was kind of what was seen as the norm. I think a lot of blokes do that too. But I think that's probably one of the main differences. It's that sort of trying your hardest to fit in and ended up getting to the point where you're just physically exhausting yourself and not quite understanding why. And because it's harder for a woman to get a diagnosis because it's historically seen as a male thing, then the woman might end up with lots of different diagnoses, some which may be correct as well, but, you know, we meet people who've been diagnosed with OCD, anxiety, depression, personality disorders, which they might have some of those as well, but they might be actually they're an autistic person. Yeah, they might have had depression, anxiety as well. And they might have a personality disorder, but actually quite often that's a misdiagnosed thing. It's because people just is sometimes the last thing people think is, oh, that lady might be an autistic lady.
I saw some research on autism about women, and one lady said that she had 5 years of counselling and never once did anyone ever float the idea that she may be autistic. And she felt that that was, in the end, the root cause of why she felt the way she did.
Yeah, and I suppose it depends on the counsellor. The counsellor doesn't really understand autism or have their own misconceptions about autism because they've probably come from a mental health background. They might be really good at counselling people, but I suppose if you're not looking for something, you're going to miss things. In the same way, if someone came to me for an autism diagnosis, I can do a diagnosis and I can look for autistic traits, but they could have all other sorts of conditions that I'm highly unlikely to pick up on, or I might pick up on if they're really obvious, but I'm not going to pick up on, you know, the subtle traits of a mental health condition because that's not my training. So it'd be better if, especially therapists, had really good understanding, because a lot of people, when they're struggling, that's where they end up. They end up getting sent to primary mental health services.
I think I would agree with you about women. I've had this discussion with men on the autistic spectrum about the specific issues about women around fitting in, about what's acceptable in society in terms of eccentricity, that often, for whatever reason, that if a man is quirky and eccentric, he's a leader, he can have his own ways and run his own businesses, and that is, in, you know, I see that as an advantage in men. It's seen as, oh, well, he's his own man, he's got these quirky sensibilities, which women simply at this time do not get away with, as far as I can see.
Yeah, no, I agree. But like I say, but I do meet men that will probably say, actually, I felt loads of pressure to fit in, and I found it probably very hard as well. So I think the masking thing, I think, is more prevalent with ladies, but I don't think that's to say that all men that are autistic, especially to get a late diagnosis, would say, I was just free to be myself all my life and it was really easy.
Oh, definitely not. No, absolutely. And we're not saying that for one second. No, absolutely. Everybody is forced to fit in. I think it's just that women are even more berated when they stand out, I think, a little bit in terms of being different, having quirky glasses on or having really short hair or anything like that is sort of seen as different. But I think that's quite an interesting conversation. Do you think that there are differences in the diagnosis between men and women that need to be recognised? Are you seeing any symptoms even or behaviours that are either more subtle in women or are extra even from the standards that we have at the moment?
I think when you're going through the diagnosis, I think it's not so much that some people say the tools are a bit skewed towards diagnosis for a man than it is for a woman. I'm not quite sure if that's true or not. I think it might just be the way you, either the way you ask the questions or the way you interpret the questions. Because stereotypically, women's, I don't like the word obsessions, but it's negative, but the things that women, autistic women, are really, really interested in might be things that are a bit more, might be different to the things that men are into. It might be things like, some might be into soap operas. Well, that seems like a perfectly normal, for want of a better word, interest, but to the point where they know everything about soap operas. Or it might be someone's really into cats, but it's everything they do is about cats. They just love cats so much. Cats are the best thing in the world. It kind of is kind of an obsession. So I don't think it's particularly that the tools need to change. I think it's just, I suppose you need people doing the diagnosis that have met lots of autistic men and lots of autistic women and can pick up on the subtleties and not expect to have the same answers and not expect to have to interpret things the same way. It might be that when you're asking about people's play when they were children, women might be a bit more prone to imaginative play than autistic blokes, or again might have sort of blended in more with the other girls, so it looks like they were doing something that actually it was a bit more copying. They might be more prone to copying the children than a lad was, and the lad might be just more happy to go and do his own thing, and sort of nobody thought that was an odd thing for a boy to do. But if the girl wasn't fitting in with the other girls and playing with dolls, that might in some places be seen as a bit of an unusual thing, so they got more pressure into fitting in.
I think the dynamics in a women's relationship is quite interesting, because you're not often the girls, not always, I'm sure some autistic girls can argue with me on this one, you're not always the person on the sidelines exactly, not fitting in. You are in the throes of it. Women are quite nurturing and you'll end up with them, but you'll end up in a sort of gossiping circle that you don't quite get, or your moves won't be quite as good. But you're there with the baby dolls joining in, but you're the bossy one, or you're seen as a very shy one, or you take on a role and that suits you. Whether if you're quite dominating, that might suit you. If people are younger with you, if you're quite shy, that might get you, someone might nurture you. You know, you're in there and you are having similar issues to the boys by not feeling left out and feeling that you don't understand people. But at the same time, you're sort of in the throes of I don't know, girls are sort of a little bit, they appear to me a little bit more cliquey and talkative, and you'll sort of be invited in almost, but then be almost like the outsider in the group, if that makes sense. I feel that that's more of where I see the differences.
Yeah, and I think stereotypically a lot of ladies I meet actually get on better with males, maybe because when they were at school, girls weren't very nice to them because they were sort of struggling to understand the rules a little bit more. But also quite a lot of men I meet get on better with ladies, and that's maybe because they were bullied by boys when they were at school. I think the sexes tend to be horrible to people that they see as a bit different amongst their own sex for some reason.
And when we're with people that are so, I always find it with age group as well, when you're with people that are so similar to you, you can be judged along those lines, but we make allowances for the other gender, the opposite gender, because we know they're different.
Yeah.
Just like we'd make allowances for people who were from a different part of the country or had a different language. We sort of make allowances for that because we know that, or someone that's younger than us or someone that's older than us. It's when you're directly comparable that you stand out even more, I think.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And that sort of, I think that's one of the reasons why school, because school's like probably the most social time of our lives, and that's often, especially high school, where people first start to really find life challenging because there's so many unwritten rules and it's so cliquey, like you say, and you probably can buy a book that says how to interact with people at high school, but it's not going to cover everything and it's not something you can memorize. And if you're having to think about the rules all the time, then that's going to make it really challenging. And then you add to that the fact that there's hundreds and hundreds of other kids there and you're all crammed into a small space and it's really busy and bright and loud and smells. You can see why a lot of people find that high school is the time when they first start to think, actually, I'm struggling a bit more than most other people.
Auti Talk.
Thank you so much to Jed. Well, that's it. It brings us to the final episode of Series 1 of Auti Talk. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Louise Crooms, and I wanted to make this podcast so that you could learn more about autism on behalf of me and my family and everyone who's been involved, just ordinary people who've come here to talk about their experiences, which hopefully will help you in some way, whether you're autistic yourself or whether you know or support someone. I went to a conference the other day, and we worked out that there's probably around 3 million people in the UK alone who either are autistic or are working very closely with someone who is, either because they're a parent or because they're a teacher or a helper in some way, a support worker. So we know that it affects so many people, and that's just in the UK. So thank you very much to everyone who's appeared on the podcast. They're just ordinary people from the north of England. Thank you to Andy, Joe, Meg, Steve, and the man who diagnosed me, Jed, the autism specialist nurse. I hope we've offered you something, and I do hope to bring back a series two. I will be talking to people in series two who've gone on to live exceptional lives, and I hope this to be an inspiration. I'm also going to be searching more diverse and interesting stories, looking at different elements with autism. This is just the very beginning to give you the very basics, and I will be off for series two. Hopefully it will be out by 2020. It's just me on my own making this, so it'd be wonderful if you can share the news, share the love, give us a review, and have a look on my website, autitalk.com. I'll see you soon.